The neuroscientist, Lisa Feldman Barrett, is profoundly changing our understanding of the brain, and in particular, our emotions. Since the ancient philosophers, and into our last century of scientific endeavour, emotions have been seen as hardwired responses to external stimuli located in specific regions of the brain. Lisa's work has overturned this age-old model, which shapes everything from our current beliefs about emotional intelligence to facial recognition software widely being deployed around the world. If you're interested in better understanding yourself and the world, this is essential listening.
Hi, friends. Welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast. I'm Scott Allender, and with me, as always, is the impeccably dressed John Gomes.
How are you feeling, Scott?
Super energized. I've been looking forward to being in our recording studio with our guest today for a long time, and I know you have too. Do you want to tell us about how you're feeling?
I'm feeling like you. I'm super energized and happy, and I'm paying attention to my emotions because today we are joined by Lisa Feldman Barrett, author of this incredible book, How Emotions Are Made, The Secret Life of the Brain. Dr. Barrett, welcome to the Evolving Leader Podcast. We're absolutely delighted to have you here. It's fair to say that your book and work has made a profound impact on us and many others, and not in the incremental sense of understanding, but a paradigm shift. Often that phrase is really inappropriately used. But in the case of the theory of constructed emotion, it's undoubtedly warranted. So welcome.
Thank you. Thank you so much for having me on your show.
So, Lisa, can you start by giving us a quick tour of your journey and your career and what inspired you to write this book?
Sure. I mean, I originally went to graduate school thinking that I was going to become a therapist. So I was training to be a clinical psychologist. And while I was training, I had to do research, and none of the studies that I was running were conducting were replicating. So what you do when you go to graduate school is usually try to replicate things that have been published first, and then you go on and do your own studies. And I couldn't get anything to replicate. And I actually thought about dropping out of graduate school because I thought, well, clearly I'm just not cut out for this science business. But the findings that were failing to replicate had to do with people's reports of emotion about how they felt. And what I realized was that these failures to replicate other people's work could be re-described as me replicating my own findings again and again and again. And this began a mystery for me that shifted my entire trajectory of my scientific work. And I ended up not going into clinical practice, but actually taking an academic job and founding a scientific laboratory, which is now, we're almost in our 30th year. In the process, I retrained as a neuroscientist. And, you know, I would say up until about 2013, I had very little interest in speaking to the public directly. I felt that I really didn't feel like I had anything to say. I'm a scientist. I'm most comfortable in a laboratory doing research. Our lab is very large even for a neuroscience lab, and very productive. And so I have a lot of young scientists who I mentor, and that was really my main focus, doing research on emotion. And the dilemma that I encountered really when I was a graduate student was very, very hard to unravel. And this was the idea that, you know, what I was observing when I was a graduate student over and over and over is that people fail to make distinctions between certain types of emotional experiences. So when they report feeling anxious, they also report feeling angry and depressed and guilty. And when they report feeling happy, they also report feeling tranquil and excited. And so pleasant or unpleasant. And I originally had thought when I was a student, you know, maybe people just aren't aware of the emotions they're having. So the problem is that the emotions themselves, the way I was thinking at the time, the emotions themselves were distinct, but people were unaware of those distinctions. So they were basically emotionally unaware. And I thought, well, I'll just find what the objective markers are of these emotions, be able to measure people objectively what their emotional states are, and then maybe even be able to teach people how to become more aware. That was sort of the general idea. And all the way through graduate school and into the beginning of my academic career, my scientific career, I realized that there actually are no objective markers of any emotion category at all. You know, Darwin is touted as having said, Charles Darwin, that, you know, every emotion category has its own distinct facial expression. When you look at the evidence, and I just published a paper last year with four other senior scientists. We reviewed over 1,000 papers. You know, what you find is that the American or Western stereotype for an anger expression, say, like scowling, right, is the expression. Everyone around the world is supposed to scowl when they're angry, and we're supposed to recognize scowls as anger. Well, it turns out that in large urban cultures, about 30% of the time people scowl when they're angry. That's more than chance. So scowling is an expression of anger, but people do many, many different things with their faces when they're angry. And about 70% of the time they're not scowling. So we call that low reliability. And they scowl when they're not angry. They scowl when they're concentrating hard. They scowl when they want to indicate that something isn't very funny. They scowl when they have gas, you know? And so that's very low specificity. And
yeah, I noticed that in Scott a lot.
And so everything that you measure about emotion, whether it's the face or the voice or physical changes in the body or even neural patterns of neural activity in the brain, there's no one-to-one mapping for a specific physical pattern and a specific emotion, instance of emotion. And so this is what I studied. And I studied this kind of paradox, which is that many people experience anger and sadness and fear, happiness, gratitude, awe, pride. We experience these emotions as distinct, but we often don't report them that way, and we can't find a single physical marker to distinguish these categories. This to me seemed like a really, really interesting puzzle, which I worked on for about 25 years. And, you know, there are competing views, and it's a very contentious debate. It has been really for the 150 years that scientists have been studying emotion. And I had no interest really in talking to the public until 2013, when a young journalist came to me and really wanted to write about this paradigm shift that was this kind of scientific revolution that we were really egging on, I would say, in our lab and with some other labs. And so she wrote, she spent probably 6 months interviewing me and wrote this article. And then her editor wanted to know why anybody should care. Like, so who cares if we believe that emotions work one way and actually, you know, they work another way? And who cares if there are no objective markers for emotion? Like, why does any of this matter? So she came to me and she said, you know, can you please explain what the implications are? And I was, you know, my reaction was sort of like what I would now think of as kind of dismissive, you know, like, why should I have to explain this? It's just, I'm doing science. Do we ask people, you know, when they want to study the Higgs boson, do we ask them why? Why do they want to study this? What's interesting about it? No, they just study it, you know? So just be interested in how things work. Your brain is a really interesting organ. Just be interested in how it works. You know, like, why do I have to, why does it matter? Why do I have to have like some big immediate, implication for the public? And she just, you know, her editor just basically refused to publish this. And it was her first feature article. And I felt really bad. And she spent all this time talking to me. And so I sat down and thought about it for 5 minutes. And I realized, actually, it's pretty serious that people are using the wrong ideas about emotion. Wars have been started. People have been killed. Children have, you know, who like with autism and so on, have been given treatments that can't work, and would, they don't work, but they would, there's no possibility that they could work. And that may sound like hyperbole, but it really isn't. And I realized that it was really important that people understand that science matters to their everyday life. And when physicians and lawyers and economists and all the people, teachers, all the people who are making decisions about you and your outcomes are using the wrong idea about how something works, something as important and central as emotion, that's a pretty serious thing. And so I decided I swore I would never write a popular science book. And so I just violated my own claims and wrote one and thought, well, what I can do is I can just put the information out there. And if people find it useful, great. That would make me really happy. So far, 3.5 years later, the book is still, seems like it's still having an impact on people's lives, at least from what I hear over email and so on, for the better.
So you've upended the classical view, is how you describe it. And it's so fascinating. And when I read your book, I was loving it. And I was also kind of frustrated because I realized I was carrying around this sort of classical view and I didn't really want it upended in me. So what was really clear for me in the book was that there's not a consistent expression of emotion, like you just talked about, right? The scowl could mean different things, but where the emotion lives in the brain, you talked a lot about that as well. You did some, you talked about amygdala damage in a patient and how the brain constructed emotions in different ways. Can you start to illuminate a bit of that for us?
Sure. Well, I mean, the way to think about a fingerprint, or in science, we would refer to it, sometimes people will refer to it as an essence. That there's an essence to the cat, to a category. So a category like anger or a category like fear, all the instances of fear, say, will have a common observable pattern. That pattern might not occur every time, but it will occur enough times with enough regularity that you could diagnose someone as being afraid based on the presence of these features, like a wide-eyed gasping a stare, or a scream, or the likelihood of running away, or sweating, or heart racing, right? So that there's some pattern that occurs. And the assumption is that this pattern is caused by an internal essence, like a circuit in the brain. And I chose fear as the example because for many, many years, scientists believed, and some scientists still believe, that the amygdala, which is a cluster of cells deep inside the temporal lobe of your brain, that this cluster of cells contains the circuit for fear. And what's interesting about that is the circuitry in the amygdala. So the amygdala is not really one thing. It's actually a cluster of, a bunch of, it's like a bunch of little clusters, actually, which sit together tightly integrated. And if you look at brain imaging studies, about 30% of the studies when we induce fear in the lab, about 30% of the studies show an increase in amygdala activity. But that means 70% of the studies don't. That's a lot of studies where people are experiencing fear and there's no change, no noticeable change in the amygdala. Also, there's an increase in amygdala activity in lots and lots and lots of other emotion categories, and even in instances that people don't experience as emotional at all. So for example, if I just show you something novel that you've never seen before, like a person's face you've never seen, or a scene that you've never seen before, or an object you've never seen, and I stick your head in a brain scanner while I'm doing this, we'll see massive changes in upregulation and amygdala activity that has nothing to do with emotion. But I think the key findings here are that, first of all, there's a woman who has full amygdala damage on both sides. So there, you know, you have two sides of your brain and there's an amygdala on each side. And she lost both amygdala when she was 12 due to an illness. And she experiences fear. She doesn't experience the full range that a neurotypical person would experience, but she definitely experiences fear. She just doesn't use the word fear, but she can learn fear, you know. So if she goes to the dentist and she has a really painful experience at the dentist, she never wants to go back to the dentist. That's what scientists call fear learning. In the laboratory, we induce fear learning, I'm putting that in scare quotes, it's really called classical conditioning or Pavlovian conditioning for the psychology wonks who are listening. But fear learning is basically, we sort of will show someone, like a colored block, like a blue square, and then we shock them with electrical current. And we just do that over and over. And eventually they have a reaction to the blue square because their brain is predicting that the shock is going to come. Well, she doesn't show that response, you know. But she does show fear learning, you know, in the real world in relation to dentists and police and, you know, things that are very impactful in high intensity. Even more importantly, there's a case that's been studied in the literature of twins. These are two women who are genetically identical, and they both have high school degrees. They married very similar guys. They live very close to one another. So their lives are really similar. They both developed this disease that caused them to lose the majority of their amygdala tissue. One of them shows similar deficits, sort of similar pattern to this other patient, SM, who I just mentioned. But her sister is completely normal with respect to her fear responses. So that must mean that there must be multiple ways that your brain can make an instance of fear, can cause you to be fearful. That's also why only 30% of the studies that's one explanation for why only 30% of the studies show an increase in amygdala activity during fear. Your brain has lots of, when something is really important to a biological system, that biological system will have multiple ways of making it. That's a concept in biology called degeneracy. It's a really crappy name, but that's the name. It just means basically there's more than one way to skin a cat. You know, when something is really important, that biological system finds more than one way to make that thing that's important. And if that way, if you lose one path, one way, you still have the capacity, the function is still maintained. So the amygdala, its main function is not fear. It sometimes is the neurons in the amygdala are sometimes involved in creating fear, but not always. And expressions of fear are highly variable, even within, you know, people within a single culture and even within a single animal in responding to threat. And some expressions of fear in other cultures seem really odd to us. You know, like in Bali, for example, the stereotypic thing to do in fear is not to freeze or to run away. It's to fall asleep.
Hi, producer Phil here. If you're enjoying the Evolving Leader podcast, then please do subscribe and follow us on LinkedIn and Instagram so you catch all future episodes. Now, let's get back to the show.
So, Lisa, let's shift on to your theory for a moment. And you've done a huge amount of work, so there's a lot of moving parts to this. I remember having to read several parts of the book several times just to get these parts into my head. You know, we've got this classical view, which has been so dominant to our understanding. And probably one of the simplest ways of understanding it is this notion that you have parts of the brain associated with different types of emotion, so your hardwired emotions. You have fear circuits like the amygdala, and then something triggers that from an external perspective. So, you know, it's the proverbial, you know, snake in the grass, or it's the car about to run you over. and you get a triggered response, which is accompanied with what we all know, like the heart rate going up and adrenaline, cortisol coursing around your body and so on. And then you move into action and it's fight or flight and so on. That feels so intuitively right. And I know science is built out of metaphors. So it's a really simple, easy to go to metaphor. And it's been dominant in our world for a long time. Let's break down what this constructive theory of emotions looks like. Can you give us the building blocks?
Sure. And I really appreciate that you asked in the way that you did, because oftentimes when I'm talking with people, they'll ask me for the punchline before they have the ingredients, the building blocks. And I think one of the reasons why the classical view makes so much sense to us is that it's grounded in kind of a cherished narrative that has been in Western civilization really since the time of Plato. And that's this idea that you have an inner beast and you have a rational self, and the two are really, there's a battle, constant battle between your inner beast and your rational self for control of your behavior. And when your inner beast wins that battle, the assumption is that you're either immoral or you're sick. And, scientists took those ideas, which really come from Plato, and they sort of tattooed it onto the brain. Because, the brain it's like a big gray blob, and it, without special tools, it's really easy to impose a sort of an architecture on it. That story kind of worked, actually. When you just look at the brain with the naked eye, it sort of fits. Unfortunately, when we start really peering into the brain with specialized tools, what we find is nothing that looks like that story. And when we start really observing how people experience emotion and behave in emotional situations, and we look outside our own culture to other cultures that are, especially those that are remote or smaller scale cultures, we see tremendous variability in how people, even in our own culture. Think about what you do. What do you guys do when you're afraid? I mean, sometimes you might freeze, but sometimes you will attack, like yell, or, sometimes people laugh in the face of fear. I mean, people do many things in fear. So I think the first thing to understand is that fear is not a thing. It's a population of instances, meaning, you do lots of things in fear. Your brain can make fear in lots of ways. There isn't really one. There's maybe a vocabulary of fear that your brain can make. That's the first thing to understand. And that's true of every emotion. Every emotion is really not a thing. It's a category, and it's a variable category. What your brain is always trying to do is it's trying to make an instance of emotion that fits the situation that you're in. So that's the first, I think, building block, is to understand that we're dealing with a lot of variability. That's what your brain has to deal with. I think the second thing to realize is that, what is your brain's main job? Think about what your brain's main job is. Your brain's main job is not to think or to have emotions, to make emotions or to smell or see or do any of those things. Your brain's main job, it evolved to regulate your body. That's what it's doing all the time, as you're thinking and feeling and seeing and imagining and so on. That's not how it feels to you or to me, but that actually is what's happening. And to do this, your brain is essentially running a budget for your body. So it's not budgeting money, it's budgeting salt and glucose and oxygen and all the things that, all the resources that your brain needs to keep your body healthy. So it's trying to figure out where all of these nutrients need to go. And if you don't have one bank account, you have lots, because you have lots of systems in your body. So the way to think about it is, when your brain is going to stand you up, it's going to raise your blood pressure as you're standing, or maybe just a little before, so that oxygen can make it to your brain so you don't faint, because that is metabolically costly for you to have to recover from a broken bone. So your brain is always trying to anticipate the needs of your body and meet those needs before they arise. And that's what body budgeting is for. And your body is always sending sensory cues about that body budgeting to your brain. And your brain has to make sense of those. Now, here's a really interesting thing. From a brain's perspective, you take the brain's perspective, it is trapped in a dark, silent box called your skull. So your brain is receiving sense data from your body. It doesn't know what's actually happening in your body. It doesn't know the causes of those sense data. It only knows the effects. So it knows something's going on down there. It just doesn't know what. It has the effects. It gets the sense data, which are the result of something, but it doesn't know the cause. Similarly, out in the world, you know, your brain gets flashes of light and changes in air pressure, which, you know, transduce through your ear, becomes sound, and chemicals that become smell and taste. And again, your brain is receiving the results of some changes in the world, but it doesn't know what they are. So if your brain has to do body budgeting, and it's got to figure out what it needs to do next to keep you alive and well, and all it has are the results of things happening, it doesn't know the causes, how does it achieve its goal? And the answer is, it has one other source of information, and that is it has your past experiences that it has learned. So your brain, what it does is it conjures or reinstates past experiences to make a guess about what the sense data mean, and that's really what body budgeting is. So your brain is constantly, from the moment that you're born until the moment that you die, it is trying to make sense, meaning, of sense data from your body and from the world in order to keep you alive and well. And it has to make guesses using your past experience. And none of this is happening consciously. It's all happening basically outside of your awareness. And the last piece, which is really cool, is that these guesses that your brain makes happen predictably. They happen before the sense data arrives. So basically, if we were to stop time right now, what would be happening for you, for me, for all the listeners, all our listeners right now, is each brain would be taking stock of what just occurred and using past experience to make a set of predictions about what is going to happen next. What am I going to see next? What am I going to hear next? How am I going to feel next? What's going to happen in my body next? What actions do I need to take next? And then your brain starts to prepare those sensations and actions. And then it waits for the sense data to come from the world and from the body to either confirm or change those predictions. And so when your brain uses past experiences of anger to make sense of the sense data in the moment, your brain is basically conjuring up an instance of anger. You'll be experiencing your racing heart and your flushed face and your tears as anger. And if your brain was using past experiences of fear, you would be experiencing your racing heart and your flushed face and your tears as fear. And if your brain was using past experiences of joy to make sense of those sensations, you would be experiencing joy. Your brain basically uses your past in order to make sense, to predict and make sense of your immediate future, which becomes your present.
Why are they felt? So these predictions that are happening. So there's this interplay between making sense of our body budget, drawing on current context, past experience, using concepts to give us language about what's happening. Why is that experienced as a feeling instead of just cognitive information? Why is that feeling sometimes more intense than other times? And why do some people, and this is kind of a, obviously a generalization, but I know people who, you know, have emotions, and I know people who seem to, you know, be their emotions, right? They have a very intense emotional experience of life. I know there's a lot of questions in that, but.
Yeah. So I will say that no one has emotions. Everyone makes emotions. You may not be aware that you're making them, but right. You are. So that's just the first thing to realize. You know, you are your brain, or, you know, you are your brain that is having a constant conversation with your body. So you're making them. But, you know, Scott, the question that you're asking, why isn't all of this stuff that's happening under the hood just happen? Like, why do we feel it? No one knows the answer to that question. I mean, that's the gazillion dollar question. Why did evolution endow us with this capacity? And how much can other animals feel too? And I don't think nobody can really answer that. But one thing that we know for sure is that in the evolution of animals, better ability to sense the world around you and to sense your body results in better control of your body budget and your actions. So sensation, you sense things because as an animal, because it helps your nervous system control your actions and control your body budget better. That's why we sense things. So the interesting thing about sensations from the body is that you don't experience those sensations directly. Like when you look out in the world, you experience vision, right? You see things in a very, very high dimensional way, because you see lots of details. You see colors, you see lines, you can see things in really high detail. The sense data coming from your body, you aren't really wired to feel it directly, to sense it directly. I mean, right now, you're sitting there quietly with a set of headphones on, but inside your body, there is a whole drama going on continuously. I mean, basically, everybody has going on inside them a constant drama that they are largely unaware of. And that's a really good thing, because if you were aware of all the sensations going on inside your body at any given moment in time, you would never pay attention to anything outside your own skin ever again. So the way that we're wired is to experience that whole orchestra of sensations as feeling pleasant or comfortable, feeling unpleasant or distressed, feeling really worked up or feeling really calm. We call this mood. Scientists call it affect. And that affect, that mood, is with you every waking moment of your life, because your brain is always regulating your body budget and your body is always sending sensations back to you, sense data back to your brain. And your brain is always conjuring that into feeling. So whether your brain makes that into an emotion or not, you are constantly in a state of feeling. Feeling, those affective feelings are properties of being conscious. They are not properties of emotion per se. But
it's fascinating.
Your brain has to make sense of them. So how does your brain know whether an ache in your gut is hunger or anger or longing or anticipation? How does it know? And the answer is it doesn't. It's guessing. It's guessing based on the context that you're in. It's making a guess. And this is really important because your brain can guess wrong, and so can physicians. So the answer, I think, Scott, to your question is we have feeling, because feeling lets us know, generally speaking, whether everything is okay with our body budget or not okay. If you're feeling pleasant and comfortable, things are pretty okay, your body budget is solvent. If you're feeling uncomfortable, distressed, fatigued, things are not okay with your body budget. That doesn't tell your brain what's wrong. It's just something is wrong. And it gives you a little bit of extra control to try to figure it out when it's not really clear. I mean, that's the best guess that we can have. But the important thing to know is that your body budget, the sensations that come from your body budgeting and the affect that you experience it as, that's with you all the time. When you're driving, well, when I used to drive, I mean, it's, you know, in this COVID moment, I'm not driving very much, but, you know, when you drive on the street and somebody cuts you off on the highway or something, and your immediate reaction is, that guy is an asshole. Their affect, your affect is, your brain is constructing it as a property of that assholeness of that person. You're not experiencing yourself as angry. You're experiencing the affect, the intense affect, that disruption in your body budget as a property of that person, as evidence that that person actually is an asshole, as opposed to somebody who just didn't see you, or maybe somebody who's racing to the hospital to sit, to try to, you know, because his kid is sick or something.
Are you listening, John?
My point is that affective is important, but it's not very informative on its own. Your brain has to make it meaningful in order to know exactly what to do about it.
So let me just move this to something slightly different in terms of, you've got this interplay, sense-making interplay between your predicting brain, making sense of affect, the circumstances you're in, and you are making a distinction here between this body budget, this affect, which is not the same as emotion. It's the feeling senses within your body, and it's sometimes referred as interoception, I think. Then that plays out in terms of your interpretation of this in language, the words that you use to describe the emotions.
Yeah, what I would say is that your brain is making sense. Really what it's doing is it's making sense of interoceptive cues, which are cues from your body that you experience consciously as affect. And it's doing this continuously. And sometimes it makes emotion when there's a big disruption in your body budget, because your brain is expecting to make a big outlay of energy, or when you're feeling really fatigued because your body budget basically is running a deficit. Your brain makes sense of those moments as emotions, because in our culture, big changes in affect usually are understood as emotion. And the language that you use comes along. It's not that language is driving this. It's that when your brain is making a prediction, really what it's doing is it's constructing a concept. So figuratively speaking, when your brain has to make sense of sense data, it's not asking, what is this? It's asking, what is this like? What is this similar to? The last time I was in this situation with these sense data, what caused these sense data? What did I do next? What did I feel next? And in psychology, a group of things which are similar to one another is a category. So you could say your brain is constructing a category, or, you know, a representation of a category in your mind is called a concept. So you could say, well, your brain is using past experiences to conjure a concept that's tailored to this specific situation to anticipate and make sense of the sense data, so that it knows how to act. And if it's using past experiences that someone taught you were anger, then it's making anger. If it's using past experiences that someone taught you was determination, then you're making determination, and so on.
Can you talk a little bit about emotional granularity in this context? Because that forms a very important part of your thinking.
Well, emotional granularity is the word is the name that we gave to a phenomenon that I think many, many people understand. And that is, what is the precision with which a person's brain can make emotion concepts? So for some people, they understand irritation and frustration and anger and rage to be very different experiences. For some people, those are all synonyms of the same experience, anger, it's all part of the same concept, but that's distinct from sadness and fear. For some people, sadness and fear and anger are synonyms to mean, I feel bad, I feel like crap. And we could do the same thing on the positive end. what I'm describing is that people differ in the precision with which their brain can make emotions. So in a similar way, you know, I might distinguish between cyan blue and peacock blue and navy blue and royal blue and cobalt blue, whereas my husband might see blue. And somebody from the Barenmo tribe in Papua New Guinea would see blue as a variety of green. The wavelength of light is the same. That's the sense data. But the experience of the color, which involves not just the sense data, but also your brain's using past experience to make sense of that sense data, is different. And so people learn, your emotion concepts come from where all your abstract concepts come from. You learn them because someone taught them to you. If you have kids and you might point out a truck to your kid, or you might show a kid a little toy dog and label the dog for the kid. What you're doing basically is you're teaching a child concepts when you do that. You don't realize that's what you're doing, but you're basically taking experiences and wiring them into the brain, because a baby's brain is born under construction. So you're wiring the concepts of a culture into that child's brain for use in later prediction and construction of regulation of action. And the same thing happens with emotion categories that happens with any kind of category, like animals and food and whatever. You're basically equipping the brain to make sense of sense data so that we can think and feel and do all the things that we do very naturally.
What are the implications of having more kind of emotional granularity or less, do you think?
Well, I don't have to think. I mean, I the evidence is that more granularity, better granularity, is better for your mental and physical health. The way we think about knowledge or concepts is that they're like tools for regulating your body budget. The more precise tools you have, like think about when you're building something, right? If, you know, my husband in his toolbox has like, I don't know, 100,000 kinds of screwdrivers, like every size, every kind of head, you know, that's a bit of an exaggeration, but like there are a lot of them. And so, but he has very precise tools and he can build very precise things. If he only had one tool, like one screwdriver, he wouldn't be able to build as many things and they wouldn't look as nice and they wouldn't be as functional. It's sort of a similar thing, that the more precision and flexibility your brain has, the more granularity, the more granular, the more precise and specific instances of emotion can be tailored to a particular situation, the less drag there is on your body budget. And as a consequence, you're less likely to get sick. It's much easier for you to cope with challenges that will, you know, that you would face on a day-to-day basis. So you're less likely to use alcohol or to deal with like stresses, for example. And when you're sick, the evidence suggests, miraculous to me, that actually you get better faster. The inference we're making is those are observations that have been published. The inference we make is that it must be because the granularity buys you a couple of things. It allows your brain to regulate your body more precisely, with less kind of drag or tax on your body budget. And it also allows you to communicate to other people more precisely. And we are social animals. We don't just regulate our own body budgets. We make metaphorically investments and like deposits and withdrawals from other people's body budgets. And so anything which is going to facilitate precise communication is going to be beneficial.
Lisa, thank you so much. We will really look forward to seeing you again. Yeah.
Yeah. Thank you so much for having me on the show. I really enjoyed it.
Thank you.
Okay, bye guys.
Take care. Bye. Bye-bye.
From the start of this interview, we knew we'd only scratch the surface of Lisa's work, so she kindly agreed to return for a second interview where we dig deeper into her findings and start to discuss their application for leaders.